Fiorina, Carson, Huckabee, Sanders. Presidential candidates are now flooding onto the campaign landscape. But a new poll shows Scott Walker the top dog among Republicans in Iowa. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our analysts today, Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. They'll give us their take on the burgeoning field of presidential candidates. Also, Iowa is one of the most crucial and consistent battleground states in the nation. Donna and Chris will share their research on why that is. And we'll discuss their panel study of Iowa voters. It reveals how Iowans' attitudes towards the governor, the state legislature, and Congress have shifted. Join our discussion for Politics Day. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Day once again here on River to River, as we like to do on Wednesdays, survey the political landscape. And of course, now that we're, what, 8-9 months away from the Iowa caucuses, increasing news there. Joining us this hour, I'm in the Cedar Falls studio here at Iowa Public Radio. Donna Hoffman with me in the studio, Associate Professor of Political Science and Department Head at the University of Northern Iowa, and Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science, also at the University of Northern Iowa. Nice to sit across the table from the two of you and see your faces.
It's good
afternoon.
Cedar Falls. Thanks for having us.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, so let's make sure we do that. A little bit later, we'll talk about some of your research about why Iowa is one of the most crucial and consistent battleground states in the country. That coming a little bit later in the program, but let's catch ourselves up on some of the latest political news. A new poll just out this morning, 6 o'clock our time, from Quinnipiac University, puts Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker as a big leader among likely GOP caucus participants. There's a scramble for the second place there. I'd like to get your comments on that. Walker, 21% of likely GOP caucus participants. In second place, we have Rand Paul, Marco Rubio of Florida, 13%. Ted Cruz, 12%. Mike Huckabee, 11%. Physician Ben Carson, 7%. And 5% for Jeb Bush, who is often called a front runner. Jeb Bush, not declared yet. Scott Walker, not declared yet. Let me start with you, Donna. Any surprises you see in these latest poll numbers from Quinnipiac?
Well, it's always good to keep in mind that, you know, while the national media a lot of times will focus on Jeb Bush, and they perceive him kind of as being the front runner. When you look at state-to-state polls, oftentimes that picture varies. And, you know, quite frankly, if you want to think about the general election in November of 2016, because the Electoral College is the thing that actually elects the president, it's done state by state. So looking at state polls actually has a lot more value, both in the general election, but also in the primary and caucus season. And so, you know, I think it's surprising to a lot of people outside of Iowa in particular that Bush is only at 5% in this particular poll.
Mm-hmm. Also interesting here in this same poll, when likely Republican caucus participants were asked if any of the candidates there on that list they would definitely not support, who tops the no way, no how list? It is Jeb Bush with 25%, followed by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie with 20%, Rand Paul with 10%. Your thoughts on that, Chris Larimer? Why the high negatives? We can guess, but what are your thoughts on the high negatives for Jeb Bush? The family?
Well, I think that could be part of it. But, you know, if you look at the details of the poll, they ask three questions that are essentially assessing character or character flaws of the candidates. And they looked at four different candidates. They looked at Rubio, Rand Paul, Scott Walker, and Jeb Bush. And on the character of, you know, cares about you, honest and trustworthy, and then leadership quality. On all three of those, Jeb Bush ranked the lowest of those four candidates. So I don't think you get the sense that Republican caucus goers don't feel like they can relate to Jeb Bush in the same way that they can to Marco Rubio or Rand Paul or even Scott Walker, that he ranks so low. On the other hand, you know, there was the New York Times CBS News poll that came out this morning in today's New York Times. It has Jeb Bush in third as far as the candidate you would consider voting for. So he's up there with Marco Rubio and Mike Huckabee at 46%. So Within Iowa, he's not doing well based on character flaws. Nationally, though, you know, he's still certainly holding his own.
Mm-hmm. Well, your thoughts, Don, on what caucus-goers, likely caucus-goers for the GOP in this case, look at in a candidate most at this point in the race? Values, positions on issues, or electability?
Well, many of these candidates, Iowa caucus-goers, are still just getting to know. So, you know, one of the other things that the poll asks about is, you know, do you view this candidate as favorably or unfavorably, or don't you know enough about this? And so you can look at somebody like Carly Fiorina, who announced this week, and, you know, 66% of the respondents said they don't know enough about her. And so that's a good gauge. But, you know, another thing about this poll recognizes that initial question in which they're gauging, you know, who would you vote for at this point, lists, as they read it to the respondents, 14 candidates thereabouts. And name recognition is going to be a key in that, because they're, you know, so my basic point is that this is really early days in terms of polling, and there are a slew of both declared and undeclared candidates on the mm-hmm. Republican side, and we don't expect that to alleviate itself anytime soon. Only that list will grow, and so some candidates can't get lost. And so name recognition right now is something that will capture the attention of some of these respondents. And, you know, one of the things that we know about Iowa voters, Iowa caucus goers in particular, is they want to see candidates. They want to get the measure of candidates, and candidates are starting to come to the state, some more than others. And Iowans tend to hold back quite a bit to see what each candidate has to offer before they'll make a decision.
Chris Larimer.
Yeah, and just to follow up with Donna's point there, you know, the Des Moines Register has their candidate tracker tool that they look at the number of events a candidate has held in the state. And if you know, correlate that with their support in this Quinnipiac poll, you actually see a negative relationship. In other words, as the number of events goes up, you don't necessarily see their poll support going up. It's actually going down.
Why would that be?
I think it gets to what Donna's talking about in terms of name recognition at this point. It's so early that it really seems to be about people's or the candidate's name rather than people making a personal connection to the candidate. And I think that's why you're seeing Jeb Bush poll so low, is he hasn't been to the state that often. And, you know, people are picking up on some of those character flaws. They don't feel like they can relate to Jeb Bush the same way they can to some of these other candidates. So as these candidate visits, candidate events start to increase, I think you'll see the poll numbers move around quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. When and if Jeb Bush, and I think it's a matter of when he declares, we'll focus on him. But right now we want to focus on the new crop of declared presidential candidates this half hour and into the next half hour. I want to reach out to you, River to River listeners. Which of the new crop of declared candidates appeals to you? We have Carly Fiorina, Bernie Sanders, Mike Huckabee, and Ben Carson. We want to talk a little bit about them. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or go to Iowa Public Radio's social media if you'd like to join in with your question or comment. We're on Twitter. Tweet us at IPR Talk or go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Let's work through these and have you each, if I could, tell us a little bit about them, a little background profile. You mentioned Carly Fiorina, Donna, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard there. We want to listen to a comment from Carly. This is a comment she made while announcing her candidacy on Good Morning America this past Monday.
Our nation was intended to be a citizen government, and somehow we've come to this place in our nation's history where we think we need a professional political class. I don't believe that. And I will tell you, as I've been out there across the country, people don't believe that either. They're kind of tired of the political class, and they believe that we need to return to a citizen government. This is a pivotal point for our nation, and so I think it's totally reasonable to look outside the political class that's been in Washington for a really long time.
Carly Fiorina wishing we'll look outside of the political class, which you would do if you were an outsider, right, Donna?
Well, she doesn't have any political experience, so she wants to paint herself as not of the political class, probably for some other reasons as well. But she, you know, is a former CEO of a Forbes, you know, 100 company, Hewlett-Packard. So she can make the argument that, like a governor, she has executive skills, and she's going to be making that argument, I'm sure. She did run in 2010 against Barbara Boxer, the incumbent senator of California, and lost to her by about 10 points. But the fact that she has never held public office, she is out there portraying as a virtue, and there's some other candidates we'll talk about later that are doing a similar thing. And she's also female. And she can cast herself as a foil to Hillary Clinton, who's on the Democratic side. And So I think she, you know, presents to people this on the Republican in the Republican field, somebody who can speak about gender issues. The Republicans have wanted to kind of expand their reach among women, among minority voters in particular, and she can potentially make that claim. She has executive experience. She's not of the political class. And, you know, a lot of people are dissatisfied with government. This isn't a new problem. And so periodically you have candidates that will want to run for high office, and this is the highest office in the land, who will stress the fact that they're not a professional politician, and that's one of the avenues she's going to take.
Mm-hmm. Some controversy when you survey the articles about Carly Fiorina. 30,000 layoffs in her tenure at Hewlett-Packard. She, of course, is a CEO with millions and millions in her bank account, but leaving 30,000 out of work, I think her defense there is hard decisions have to be made during an economic downturn.
And these were, you know, issues that were brought up in her 2010 Senate campaign against Boxer as well, that she was involved in outsourcing jobs in particular. And, you know, those aren't new charges, and she has to be ready for responses in that regard. And certainly, you know, being an executive is hard, and making tough decisions is something that presidents have to do as well. And she even hinted at some of that in her her announcement.
Join our conversation. What do you think of the new crop of declared candidates? 1-866-780-9100. Any of them sort of strike a tone, a note, an issue that you are especially interested in? 1-866-780-9100. Ben Carson declared. He is a physician, and he's been in Iowa, in fact, on a campaign stop in Cedar Rapids yesterday. He had this comment. He spoke about throwing rocks at cars when he was a kid growing up in Detroit. Let's listen.
I mean, it was like an Olympic event. Full speed ahead, never break stride, leap high onto the fence, let the momentum of your feet swing you over the top, drop down on the other side, and laugh at them because they couldn't do that. Yeah. And that was back in the days before they would shoot you. But just kidding.
Okay, Ben Carson, not one to shy away from controversial comments, obviously. A physician, former director of the pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins. Tell us more about Ben Carson, Chris Larimer.
Well, I think you hit on it there. He's the famed neurosurgeon from Johns Hopkins. He started to get a lot of national attention in 2013 with a speech at the National Prayer Breakfast, in which he alluded to, or well, really directly criticized the Affordable Care Act, with President Obama attending the breakfast. And a lot of conservatives picked up on that. A lot of Republican voters like that idea of directly criticizing a piece of legislation they see as in desperate need of repeal. So, you know, he's someone who appeals to Republican voters. I think he, you know, with Carly Fiorina, they're both celebrity candidates in my mind. I think they're both, they're two candidates who have to do well in Iowa if they're going to have any traction moving forward. They both have a lot of money. Carly Fiorina, I think, probably has a more difficult challenge in terms of relatability. You know, this idea of the candidate caring about you, having the same interests as you, I think that's going to be a more difficult message for Carly Fiorina to play, because Ben Carson can talk about, you know, growing up poor, growing up in a low-income family. I think for Fiorina, that's a harder argument to make when you're talking about, you know, in her case, I think about a $30 million severance package when mm-hmm. she left Hewlett-Packard.
Right.
I would add, Ben, though, that she does have a compelling story as well, in that she talks about dropping out of law school, starting as a secretary, moving up the ladder. So rather than So she does have a different kind of spin on a story, much like Carson does, just a different kind of American dream story, if you will. And hers is gender-based. His is race-based.
Yeah, and I do think the one thing that they both have going for them is this outsider message. That New York Times, CBS News poll this morning, among Republicans, 73% of them would rather have a presidential candidate who they see as outside of Washington. So that's something that's going to appeal to voters. The next step for them is to really making that message stick.
Ben Carson, one of the two candidates we're talking about today, who has was hired for Fox News for some time, a relationship with Fox News from October of 2013. He ended that relationship in the end of 2014. Also notable for the comments he throws out here, one of the ones that is often quoted, calling Obamacare the worst thing to happen to this nation since slavery. This coming from an African-American candidate. So interesting there to watch that. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our phones here and talk with Tom from Missouri Valley. What do you think of the latest crop here? And your question, Tom.
Well, I just wanted to ask the two professors. My preferences are anybody that could possibly win, because I don't see any of the people that are coming forward right now could possibly ever carry and flip any of the states that went for Obama in either 2012 or 2008. I think the margin was even greater in 2012, especially the Rust Belt states in Virginia. I mean, my preference, I'd like to find out if these two think there's anybody on the stage that has policies that could actually carry the day, and that'd be my preference.
Okay. I think we got it, Tom. Electability is at the heart of Tom's question from Missouri Valley, and we have to presume at this point that Hillary Clinton would be the figure in the other column.
Well, certainly the Electoral College presents a difficult challenge for Republicans structurally. But at this stage of the game, on the Republican side, the electability question has not been really addressed quite yet. And so I think caucusgoers aren't quite there yet. So, you know, Ben Carson strikes me as a good example of somebody that caucusgoers in Iowa may flirt with, but they may not necessarily take him to the big dance. Again, we're at the stage in which we're feeling out these various candidates, seeing if they have some preliminary appeal, seeing if they have staying power, seeing if they have fundraising ability. And I think that electability question will come in a little bit later. And certainly it is a very important question for voters, but I think the voters just are still in the kind of feeling out stage in terms of the candidates.
Okay. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer, her colleague at the University of Northern Iowa, also in the Cedar Falls studio with me. And we're looking at the candidates who have declared within the past few days their intentions of running for the White House in 2016. Let's move on to Mike Huckabee, also former Fox News host and also actually a winner of the Iowa caucuses, Donna Hoffman in 2008. This was a surprise in 2008 that this pastor from Arkansas, governor from Arkansas, came and captured a lot of people's imagination and the appeal here in Iowa.
Right. He was able to visit the state quite a bit in 2008. I think he is the one who, at least he thinks that he started the pizza ranch trend in terms of candidates in 2008 going to pizza ranches in small towns in Iowa in particular and using their meeting space to meet with potential caucus goers. But in 2012, he was a Fox News commentator and didn't run in 2012. And so the question becomes whether, you know, I think many of his voters in 2012 went to Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum's in the race this time. If you look at polling, he's not doing so well in the state right now. And the Huckabee contingent seems to have gone back to Huckabee, at least for the moment. You know, one of the things I heard about Huckabee's announcement yesterday was that he had Tony Orlando there and was singing his famous song, which one of the lines in it is, "It's been 3 long years, do you still want me?" And I think he should have changed the lyrics of that. It's been, you know, 7 or 8 long years, do you still want me, for Huckabee. But certainly he is well known in the state and has a lot of appeal still left over. But there are still new voters, and he has faded a bit in terms of, you know, being thought of as a politician, because a lot of people will know him as a commentator.
Okay, let's remind ourselves of Mike Huckabee's style, his comments. Here one comment announcing his candidacy yesterday in his hometown, Hope, Arkansas.
"And we don't create good jobs for Americans by entering into unbalanced trade deals that forego congressional scrutiny, and then looking the other way as the law is ignored so that we can import low-wage labor, undercut American workers, and drive wages lower than the Dead Sea. That's unacceptable."
Okay, Mike Huckabee yesterday in Hope, Arkansas. Your comment on Huckabee, Chris Larimer.
Well, I think, you know, that clip kind of plays to his strength, is in his relatability. You know, he speaks well. Voters seem to understand what he's talking about. The challenge for him this time around, though, is, as Donna alluded to, is the fact that he's been out for so long. He ran in 2008 and won, but there are other personalities in the race. There are so many candidates that are going to be siphoning away votes from Huckabee, you know, folks like Ben Carson or Bobby Jindal or, excuse me, or Rick Santorum, who won in 2012. So I think I think there's going to be a core level of support there for Huckabee because voters feel like they can relate to him. They may have supported him in 2008, but I think, you know, getting into the top three in the Iowa caucuses at this point, I think, is a big challenge for Huckabee.
Mm-hmm. And here, it's been said before many times on this show, it may not be a matter of winning the Iowa caucuses, right, but what, beating expectations?
And there's so many candidates right now. Beating expectations is certainly important, but one of the things that's really a challenge for Huckabee is that there are so many other candidates who are vying for that evangelical vote, which really helped him in 2008. And Cruz, Rubio, Jindal, many of the candidates are going to split that up, which means a more establishment candidate may be able to pull out an unexpected win, or even doing better than expected in the caucuses. So so I think Huckabee has some challenges, as do many of the candidates right now who are vying for that evangelical vote in the state.
Politics Wednesday with Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa for this week. Let's go to our caller from Spencer. Jim is from Spencer. What's on your mind politically, Jim?
Well, a couple of things. Christian, I'm still waiting for these swift boat veterans for Benghazi to rear their ugly heads. I'm sure that's why the Republicans aren't saying anything about it. They're waiting for some committee to pop up and decide that, you know, despite all the investigations, that they know what happened there. But my original comment was that the idea of campaigning on zero experience is no way to get a job, certainly no way to run a country. And so I think it's really disingenuous for anyone who intends to run for president to use that as part of their campaign, that, you know, they're an outsider, or they, you know, they've never had any experience in politics, because, you know, we don't really seriously want that kind of person running our country, I'm sure.
Okay, Jim, thank you for your comment from Spencer, but this is a theme that comes up in every election cycle, and sometimes successful.
Sometimes successfully, but, you know, again, at this level, I think, you know, Jim, the caller is right that there is a certain level of experience that ideally we want to see in a presidential candidate. Now, that experience can take different forms through different people. So, of course, Carly Fiorina is going to argue that, you know, she has executive experience, even just not in the political field. Some voters will see that as attractive. Other voters will see that as a detriment. But there is always a candidate out there who will argue or run against Washington, D.C., if you will. You see it happen in Congress. You see it happening for presidents.
Okay, let's quickly, before the break, talk a little bit about Bernie Sanders. Chris, tell us. Bernie Sanders on the in the other column, the Democratic column, declaring late last week.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders, someone who is certainly to the left, a senator from Vermont, very far leaning to the left, you know, socialist. Someone who I think most people in the Democratic Party see as someone who can maybe pull Hillary Clinton to the left, but, you know, quite frankly, I don't think his candidacy is going to do anything to Hillary Clinton's at this point. I mean, he's there, he's in the race, he's going to shift campaign rhetoric a little bit, but, you know, at this point, I would be surprised if he gets out of the single digits in terms of polling.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could make the case that he could make Hillary Clinton look centrist even, right?
He could. I mean, the when you have these gadfly kind of candidates that happen, which I would put him in the category of, you can have them affect the debate, but you can also have them make the candidate a better general election candidate. And so he may, with a debate, help her figure out what her message is going to be, what the issue she wants to address, and how she's going to do that.
Okay, let's talk more about politics with Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. When we come back, we'll talk more about the latest round of newly declared candidates. Also, how big will national security play in this campaign, and also the environment when we get back? We had that shooting in Texas. I want to ask our analysts here if we have other attempted terrorist attacks, if that will dictate some of the things happening on this campaign. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, a recent conversation, in fact, yesterday, a conversation I had with Vice President, former Vice President Al Gore, who is in Iowa this week, training what he calls climate activists. That tomorrow on this program. Today, Politics Wednesday, we have Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, along with her colleague Chris Larimer, both in the political science department in our Cedar Falls studio. I'm joining them here. We're glad to have you on board as well. And we're working through some of the newly declared candidates, getting ourselves acquainted with these new names. Some names we're being reacquainted with. Bernie Sanders, we talked about for a minute or two before the break. We want to hear a little bit from Bernie Sanders and have a comments from Chris and Donna. Let's listen to his comments made in a press conference announcing his candidacy last Thursday. Bernie Sanders, an independent, but running for the Democratic nomination for president in 2016.
The major issue is how do we create an economy that works for all of our people rather than a small number of billionaires? And the second issue, directly related, is the fact that as a result of the disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, we now have a political situation where billionaires are literally able to buy elections and candidates. Let's not kid ourselves. That is the reality right now.
Okay, talk a little bit for us, your view on his candidacy. Chris Larimer, this is an independent, two-term senator from Vermont.
Yeah, again, I think, you know, the challenge with Sanders is really projecting himself as a viable candidate, someone who is electable, and in that electability issue. You know, you think, you mentioned Al Gore, and in 2000, Al Gore was a clear Democratic frontrunner. He had a challenge from the left in Bill Bradley, but Bill Bradley was seen as a more viable candidate, I think, at the time. The challenge for Sanders is, you know, he's talking about issues that core Democratic activists are going to agree with him strongly on and see it as very important in terms of income inequality, you know, too much money in political campaigns. But with Hillary Clinton in the field, I think his message just gets drowned out. And, you know, I don't know that he stands much of a chance to get anything beyond marginal support.
Mm-hmm. Your view?
Yeah, I would say we might look at Sanders and compare him to Ron Paul in the last cycle on the Republican side, because, you know, similarly, like Ron Paul was, he's very principled and uncompromising on his principles that appeal to a particular segment of the party. So whereas Ron Paul had libertarian bona fides, we have Sanders representing the more liberal side of the Democratic field. And so you might have some people that are brought into the campaign because he is in it. And again, as we were talking about before the break, he might raise some of these issues. We heard some of that in the clip. Certainly, we wouldn't expect to see a super PAC affiliated with Bernie Sanders, which means, you know, that's going to put him in this cycle probably at a huge disadvantage just from terms of fundraising. But he certainly is a long shot candidate at best, but he certainly could serve as someone who at least gives Democratic voters some competition on the side, maybe brings a little bit of excitement there from some of the more liberal activists, and could affect the debate, but certainly isn't somebody that we expect to win the nomination.
Donna Hoffman, Chris Larimer, let me ask you about a couple things in the news, this pertaining to national security. On Sunday, Texas police shot dead two gunmen who opened fire outside of a Draw Muhammad contest organized in the town of Garland, Texas, a contest that offered a $10,000 prize for cartoons of the Islamic prophet, of course, depictions that are considered blasphemous by many Muslims around the world. The Islamic State terror group ISIS claiming responsibility for the attack. I'm not sure whether that's been verified, but yesterday when I had Iowa Senator Joni Ernst on this program, she's a member of the Senate Armed Services and also the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committees. I asked her about the significance of this first ever attack claimed by ISIS on American soil. Here's one of the things she had to say.
Our administration has said many times over that we need to degrade and destroy ISIS. Well, we as a country are not moving forward with that. We need to engage other partners in that region that will do this for us, and we need to enable them any way that we can. This attack on our homeland, it just shows that we have not been effectively engaging overseas, mm-hmm. and our partners have not been effective in that.
Joni Ernst yesterday on this program. Obviously, a major terrorist attack on American soil would color the campaign from here on out tremendously. But your thoughts about national security as a campaign issue and how that may color it. Donna, Chris, who wants to jump in?
Well, I would just say that national security as an issue in general sometimes waxes and wanes, and it is connected to, you know, crises events many times. So you can have a campaign not necessarily being about national security, but it could quickly become about that. And again, a terrorist attack would be something that could do that. So candidates always have to have a plan, if you will, if something like that happens within a campaign, and that very quickly becomes an issue. So whereas you may have a campaign largely focused on domestic politics, they have to be ready to react to situations such as terrorist attacks.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to a relevant campaign where a candidate tried to capitalize on national security. This is an ad that many of us will remember from the 2008 campaign. I'm not sure if it came out in 2007 or 2008. It was a part of that election cycle. And this is the an ad from the last time Hillary Clinton ran for president. And let's listen. Here she tries to capitalize on her opponent's, Barack Obama's, inexperience in foreign affairs. Let's listen to this campaign ad from the 2008 campaign.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world. Your vote will decide who answers that call. Whether it's someone who already knows the world's leaders, knows the military, someone tested and ready to lead in a dangerous world. It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. Who do you want answering the phone?
I'm Hillary Clinton and I approve this message.
One of the most talked about ads from that election cycle, Hillary Clinton there, Chris Larimer. So a chance there or an attempt there to capitalize on what was seen as Barack Obama's relative inexperience.
Yeah, and I think that was the reason for the ad. I don't know that we'd see a similar ad this time around with Hillary Clinton in the field. I think you have a candidate that most people see as having enough experience, having, you know, served as Secretary of State, having foreign policy experience. On the Republican side, you know, there are still questions about electability, but we're not sure, you know, which candidate's going to emerge there. And if you have a candidate that's held elected office, whether it's a governor or a U.S. senator, there's going to be presumably some level of foreign policy experience there. Mm-hmm. So I would be surprised if we see one candidate try to exploit the inexperience of another candidate this time around. I mean, the challenge for national security is how do you get over, you know, the economy and jobs continuing to be the top issues for a presidential campaign?
And I would just add there, if you remember back to the 08 election, you know, Barack Obama really caught fire because of his stance on Afghanistan and Iraq. And then 2008 turned into an election about the economy and the economy only at the very end. So, again, things can shift very quickly.
Okay, let's talk about another comment. Al Gore in the state, as I mentioned, we can hear his conversation, my conversation with him tomorrow on this program. He's in the state to train what he calls climate activists, hundreds of them. He's been in Cedar Rapids this week. Here's some comments he made about the prevalence, the environment, global warming, climate change, how that would play in this election cycle. He's speaking here about climate change's impact on the last presidential election.
It was kind of embarrassing, I think, for our country 4 years ago when we went through an entire presidential election cycle and virtually zero questions were asked of any of the candidates in the debates, and very few of them got into it. Now, President Barack Obama actually did make some very stirring speeches about it toward the end of his campaign last time, but in the general campaign dialogue, it didn't play much of a role.
Al Gore wishes it's different this time around, hence he's in the state. Iowa, one of the few places he's coming to train activists in climate change, put that front and center. How do you view the chances that climate change will figure as one of the key issues in the 2016 race? Donna?
I don't think climate change at this point rises to one of the key issues. It certainly can be a key issue for certain voters, but it's not usually an issue that rises to the top. Now, to the extent that climate change becomes an economic issue, then it could do that, but I don't think we've reached that point yet.
Yeah, I'd be surprised, too. I think, and you know, the conversation on both sides is so polarized. You know, you really only have Bernie Sanders and potentially Hillary Clinton talking about this as a serious issue for the presidential campaign. Republicans are not going to talk about the issue. They'll talk about climate change, but not attribute it to human action. And so, again, I agree with Donna. I'd be surprised if this, you know, is one of the top three issues for voters going into the presidential election season.
Chris Larimer is with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Donna Hoffman, associate professor of political science and department head at the University of Northern Iowa's political science department. Finishing up the hour, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to ask you about your research that you've been doing. The two of you are working on a book together that looks at Iowa's past and present as a battleground, a swing state in elections, a state that is neither solidly in the Republican column nor in solidly in the Democratic column. Donna, talk about that. When did Iowa establish itself as a swing state?
Well, actually, this is a book chapter. It's going to be in a book edited by David Schultz and Stacey Hunter Heck that actually looks at about 10 states as swing states. And so Iowa used to be a relatively reliable Republican state. But in 1988, the state went for Michael Dukakis at about 8 points, and then voted for Clinton. And then, most interestingly enough, in 2000, Al Gore won the state, but only by 0.3 of a percentage point. So only about 4,000 votes is what Al Gore won the state by in 2000. Now, if you recall the 2000 election, it was very, very close, and it came down to what would happen in Florida and the Electoral College votes there. But the Electoral College votes in Iowa were awarded to Gore, and Bush only had one extra electoral vote, if you will, in winning that particular contest. And so in an age in which, you know, because Iowa didn't have that many electoral votes, and we have one fewer now than we did then, in an age where presidential contests at the Electoral College level are decided by only a few votes, smaller states, which before this period of time hadn't really been seen as swing states, become important. I shouldn't say swing states, but hadn't been seen as important. So Iowa became important. And then in 2004, very small margin, again, the state went to Bush. Only it was about 11,000 votes at that point. And so, again, we became not only important, as we know, in the nomination campaign, as we've been talking about, but we also became important in the general election, and we started seeing general election candidates really focus on the state because it became part of candidates' electoral college strategy.
You note in this chapter that the number of swing states has been dwindling in recent years, and yet Iowa is maintaining its swing state status in the way it behaves in elections. Chris, why?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I'll let Donna talk about a couple of them, but one of them that we focus on is there's really tremendous imbalance in Iowa. You know, we often think of Iowa as a state as purple, but the counties in Iowa are not purple at all. And we talk about the tremendous imbalance in terms of size. You know, we have 99 counties, but we have 9 with 50,000 or more voters in them. And those 9 counties have about 47% of the active voters in the state. So you can really think of about 90 counties in a statewide election that are almost irrelevant. We have, you know, those counties average over 100,000 voters. The other 90 are less than 12,000. You know, geographically, Iowa is very divided. We talk about a rural versus urban, but you can also obviously talk about a western part of the state versus the eastern part of the state. And we're seeing Republicans go more and more to the eastern part of the state because that's where the votes are. And you have very Democratic counties in the eastern part, in the northwest and southwest part of the state. We have very Republican parts. And those parts try to compete with one another. But I think, you know, the imbalance in Iowa ends up working out to being Iowa being this purple state. But there are a lot of moving parts in Iowa that I don't think people really pick up on just by labeling the state as purple. Mm-hmm.
And so this is very interesting, of course, to political strategists of both parties, that Iowa, as you said, Chris, is not purple. It looks purple from a distance, but when you zoom in on the county level, you've got red or blue mainly.
Yeah, it's more like a patchwork quilt, mm-hmm. if you will. Mm-hmm. And so what Chris was talking about was the political geography factor, and so campaigns have to pay attention to that. But one of the things that several of the things we talk about are more structural in nature, mm-hmm. too, in this area. One of the things that we and it's a confluence of factors. It's not any one thing that kind of contributes to this swing state status. So the precinct caucuses, for example, because we have those and they're first in the nation, those have served to foster strong party organizations in the state. And the precinct caucuses are very decentralized. So not only do we have strong state parties relative to other states, but we also have relatively strong county level parties as well. And having strong parties fosters competition. That's a factor. We have, you know, a lot of no-party voters in the state. So a plurality of voters in the state, when you look at the Secretary of State's registration rolls, will declare themselves, more than a third, will declare themselves of being of no party.
And that's greater than declaring of, either major party.
Right, exactly. So it's a plurality. And those voters, you know, because the caucuses, for example, or primary, if we're talking about another kind of statewide election, are closed, you have to be a Democrat or a Republican to participate in those. But those no-party voters can pretty easily be no-party voters and declare at the poll or at the caucus if they want that they're a Democrat or Republican. So we have those voters there, and that fosters some competition as well. And we also have a unique, really unique structural factor in Iowa, which is the way that we draw districts, both for the state legislature as well as for
the U.S. House. Model of nonpartisan selection for the country that is an outlier.
Yes, and it ought to be adopted by other states probably, but it, you know, because it is nonpartisan and a staff agency draws those lines. We also have, more than other states, we tend to have competitive House elections because the agency that draws those lines can only pay attention to the county borders and the population within those county borders. They can't even pay attention to where incumbents live. And so we have seen, and we will see even in the next cycle, competitive House races in part because of the nature of the redistricting scheme.
No reason, based on your research, your writing here, that Iowa should change as a competitive state.
We don't foresee anything in the future changing. You know, some states are having change that are happening because of demographic features, and that's really not something that we see happening at this point in Iowa.
Okay. Also, you're working with a study of Iowa voters, conducting a panel study of Iowa voters. Tell us about that, Chris.
Yeah, this was something we started in 2013. And, you know, there are a lot of great polls. Obviously, the preeminent poll in the state is the Des Moines Register Iowa poll that done by Ann Seltzer. You know, Chris Budzid at Loras has their poll that's come out. And Quinnipiac and Public Policy Polling have started polling in the state. But those are kind of snapshots in time. What we noticed was sort of lacking with Iowa, and Iowa being a swing state that we see as crucial for the presidential election, was sort of an ongoing study of the same voters over time. So, we're doing this panel study of randomly selected Iowans throughout the state. You know, we initially started off with sending out an initial survey of 3,000. We got about 717 back. And once we got those results back in July of 2013, we sent out another study in June of 2014, another one in December of 2014. And the idea is to track how these voters' attitudes are changing over time as we're leading into a presidential election cycle.
And so the types of questions you're asking over time?
Yeah, we're asking about presidential approval, approval of Congress, approval of the governor, approval of the state legislature. We're asking about key issues for key races in terms of what issues drive certain votes, whether it's for the Senate race or the gubernatorial race, you know, views on different issues affecting the state. And we're trying to track how their attitude changes over time.
What have you found?
Well, you know, Iowa gets a lot of criticism for perhaps not being like the rest of the country, but really the attitudes of Iowans, at least in our survey, very much reflect the rest of the country. You know, presidential approval is right about the low 40s over the three time periods that we have. Congressional approval is right around 7 to 11%, which, you know, tracks nationally as being very low. Iowans tend to approve of the state legislature significantly more so than they do of Congress, with state legislative approval right around 60%. And Iowans are pretty happy with the direction the state is on at this point, more so certainly than the direction they see the country on. And I think that's something that helps, you know, someone like Governor Branstad, why he was able to sort of cruise to reelection, is most people feel the state is on the right track compared to the country.
You mentioned House seats competitive in Iowa. One of the most competitive ones is right where we're seated in the first district of Iowa, now held by the first-term Republican businessman from Dubuque, Rod Blum. Last month, though, we had Gary Kroger, Cedar Falls advertising executive, former Saturday Night Live cast member, announced he's running. Before that, Monica Vernon, Cedar Rapids city councilwoman, and also a 29-year-old businessman, president of a family-owned hotel business from Cedar Rapids, Ravi Patel. By these people jumping on in the Democratic side, they're looking at the Rod Blum seat as competitive, highly competitive.
Right. Yeah, we already know that the first district was going to be competitive. It's just a competitive district. And Rod Blum, a recent PPP poll out on Blum gave him only a 31% favorability rating in the district. And the fact that, you know, Monica Vernon jumped in very quickly after the general election to vie for the nomination. We expect to have a very crowded primary feel on the Democratic side of this race because it is competitive, and that will be like it was in the last cycle.
And entertaining. Gary Kroger on Saturday Night Live in 1984. We want to listen to a short clip from him. He was known on Saturday Night Live for doing an impression of Walter Mondale. Here's after his opening to Saturday Night Live in 1984, after Walter Mondale failed to live up to at least Gary Kroger's expectations.
I'm Gary Kroger. And I spent the summer working up a Walter Mondale impression. Good thinking, Kroger. You know, I figured I'd have an impression that I could do for at least 4 years. Thanks a lot, Walter, Mr. 13 electoral votes. I only had a chance to do him once on this show, just once in a sketch last week. Some of you might have seen it. That's me here. Isn't that something? Funny how life imitates art. The sketch died, too. So now, before I hang up the nose and the hair and take off the bags, I'd like you to indulge me just for a moment. I'd like to do Walter Mondale for the very last time on this show. Live from New York, a state I thought I'd carry, it's Saturday night!
Gary Kroeger, 1984, from Cedar Falls. We'll hear Gary Kroeger talking in his political voice, I'm sure, in the future. Thank you very much, Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. River to River, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, also Julia Davis helping us out. Cedar Falls helping us out, Tony Daner and Phil Moss. Tomorrow on this program, my conversation with Al Gore, who's in the state this week. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.